This is Anodized. On this episode, we'll be talking about media stores. I'm Clinton Phillips, and joining me, as always, is John Chichi. How you going, John?
Going very well. How you doing, mate?
Yes, very good. So, on this episode, we're going to discuss the options that consumers have for getting media. So that's movies, books, TV shows, and so on. There's so much choice available to us. You know, we can buy physical content, go down to a shop and get things on, you know, a physical book or a DVD or whatever, or there's a whole range of digital content that we can get from, you know, there's a lot of options out there. So I guess the first question for us is this much choice a good thing for consumers? You know, are there benefits to the customers?
To start out with DVDs, because I guess I don't want to go back so far as VHS tapes.
No.
No, let's not do that. But DVDs, all around a common platform, you go to the shop, you go and buy yourself a DVD player, and they're all pretty much interchangeable. So you could buy any DVD you wanted, irrespective of which production studio it came from, pop it into whatever DVD player you would choose to purchase, and plug it into your TV and away you go. And that, I think, was really good for consumers because consumers didn't have to think. However, as we move down towards the digital form, whereby you can get it from iTunes or, well, I mean, let's go through the list. We got, for movies, let's see, you got iTunes, there's Google Play, Amazon Instant Video. You can get videos through Xbox Live, PlayStation Network. In Australia, of course, our quote-unquote cable provider, although the majority of the cable is actually not done through a cable, it's done via microwave or from satellite. That's Foxtel. So there's Foxtel On Demand. Telstra have a service called Big Pond Movies. There's a couple other ones I'm less heard of, but Mubi, I think it's pronounced, M-U-B-I.
That's my guess.
Yeah, Fetch TV, QuickFlix. And then, of course, those are all the digital distribution methods. DVD, of course, has moved on to Blu-ray, but Blu-ray is no different from DVD insofar as you go and buy yourself a Blu-ray player and away you go.
Doesn't matter what manufacturer you get.
Yeah.
You can play pretty much all Blu-rays.
Yes, yeah, exactly. I mean, there was that brief bullshit with HD DVD, which, you know, died, thankfully.
Yeah, glad that's over.
Yeah, exactly. And that was only ever bad for consumers. I don't want that to sound so dismissive insofar as, you know, competition is a good thing. But yeah, let's face it, when it comes to a platform like this, do you really want to have two bloody players, one for Blu-ray, one for HD DVD? Some people did that, but I don't see how that is good for consumers. Competition is good in general, but competition is only good when the platform is agreed upon. And I think that's my fundamental problem with all these digital distribution methods, is because all of them are their own bloody platform.
Yes.
So it's all well and good if you've got a computer. If you've got a laptop or a desktop, you can usually run all of those different stores that we mentioned. You can run their content in their own app or program on your computer, and or even through a web browser.
Yeah, I think Google Play was through a web browser when during my research.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah, but for example, it's just once you want to watch it on a big TV, that's where the wheels start falling off. So in order to watch iTunes content on a television, you need to buy an Apple TV to do it. Now, you could say that's no big deal. It's like $99 or $109 in Australian dollars. Irrespective, the point is that nothing you buy from Google Play will play on Apple TV. And, okay, I know, you can jailbreak the thing and you can load XMBC or whatever the hell else you want on there and blah, 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 right? But is the average person going to do that? No, they just want to walk in and buy a DVD player and pop a disc in and hit play. But the advantage of being able to download this stuff makes that very attractive, but it takes that complication to the next level. Now there's the Chromecast, and there was the Google TV, And of course, the obvious ones, Xbox, and the PlayStation Network with the PlayStation. And yeah, also quite obviously, Foxtel On Demand, you've got a DVR from Foxtel. So all of those platforms are all hardware platforms. Some of them serve other functions. But what they do is they lock you into their content, unlike a DVD player. And that's where the consumers lose.
If I were to buy content from iTunes, and I do have a fair amount of content from iTunes, I can never play those iTunes movies or those TV shows on my Xbox, even though that's the best thing that I have for connecting to our ancient TVs, because an Xbox can still do the standard definition connections, whereas brand new Apple TV, even the original Apple TV, couldn't do that. So buying media through iTunes, I'm being locked into the Apple platform, which is great while I'm still using it. But one day, if I want to move away from that, it becomes a lot harder because of that investment that I've built up with Apple over all these years.
Well, the other thing, yeah, absolutely right. And the other thing is that because Apple have chosen to use a certain kind of H.264 container in their files, often things will be distributed, or you can, let's say you buy a DVD, right? And you want to, you don't want to play on the DVD player anymore. You want to play it through your Apple TV, if you've got an Apple TV or a Roku box or a, you know, or an Xbox, whatever else. You can rip that and convert that into whatever you format that'll play on whatever you like. But because of the way they encode it, it's whatever you play on. If you were to get something for Xbox Live, that won't play through an Apple TV, and vice versa, unless you convert it, which is, yeah, another pain in the ass. So not only is it a different lock-in from the point of view of the different store provider can basically use DRM to lock you out. They can it's also different because of the different encoding methods used. So it's hard for me. Look, I see the convenience argument, right? I see, yes, it is more convenient, but seriously, is it really that much better? Because, well, DVD players were a common platform, and now that's dying, and Blu-ray players again, and it's dying slowly.
I did some research into the pricing for these various places to get movies from. So looking at the spreadsheet that I've given you, do you think that's an indication of competition between all of these various hardware vendors and their platforms?
Well, given this is a spoken podcast and they can't see the spreadsheet, basically what we've got here is a list of, we've got about 10 movies. And each of those, we're comparing the price in iTunes to buy it. This is purchase price, not rental. And how much it would cost to buy Blu-ray, or in some cases, Blu-ray, DVD, you know, combo that you've got listed here, mostly Blu-rays. So if you look at the cost of iTunes and physical media, there's a very, very tight correlation between how much you pay for iTunes and physical media. It's within... In many cases, it's within 5 cents. It's really close. The biggest deviation is $5, I think, based on what I can see. Now, then we've also got columns for Google Play, Amazon Instant Video, and Xbox Live, and they are all cheaper. Some of them significantly so. And I think that the reason for that is that Apple's approach is that, or the deal that they've struck, I presume, quite possibly, is such that they want it to simply be, you know what, you could go to the shop and buy yourself a Blu-ray, but you'd rather sit here on the couch and just hit buy, then you don't have to go anywhere. And we'll offer it to you for the same price. It's a convenience thing of not having to get off your ass and go to the store. Whereas the other guys have obviously struck different deals, or they are making less profit, or they are making a loss, not sure which of those. In any case, their prices are cheaper. They want to incentivize you to come to their platform, whereas Apple's not really incentivizing you to do that. At least it doesn't look that way. What do you think?
No, it doesn't. I don't think they are trying to attract customers with the media that they're selling. Because yeah, when you do look at the prices between a download and a physical product, there really is no difference. And in some cases, you are better off buying the physical product because you get not only do you get a Blu-ray disc, you also get the DVD and you get an iTunes copy, which you can download. So it's like three for the price of one. And then you do have that convenience of being able to watch the best quality one copy on your Blu-ray player, on your fancy TV, or you can watch it on your iPad or your iPhone or whatever you happen to have. And some people still have the portable DVD players in the car. So, you know, it's pretty much for $30, you're covering all bases. Whereas if you, for $30 from iTunes, well, you're pretty much locked into modern iOS devices and the Apple TV, and that's really it.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it's funny, I know a lot of people on Twitter that like to attribute Steve Jobs as being the genius behind everything that's happened at Apple. And whilst to some extent there's an element of truth in that, but the reality is that he wasn't the free-loving hippie that some people like to think he was. You know, he wasn't doing it just to make great products so that everyone would be happy. You know, there's a quote out of a meeting he was in saying, "We'll do blah, 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 and that will increase customer lock-in." So you think for a second that the guy was not a very, very shrewd businessman. Of course he was. And the way Apple does things, yes, it makes great products. That's a good thing. But they want to lock you in just as much as anyone else does. And the more you buy into their ecosystem, the more locked in you become. So, yeah, for someone like me that's been getting deeper and deeper into the Apple ecosystem over the last 5-6 years, let's say, I've got a lot invested in it. Now, I could still buy a Western Digital, you know, streaming box or a Roku or whatever else and get away from iTunes if I wanted to. I mean, all the files on the hard drive, I could probably do that, because that's, you know, generally the way that I've gotten my media is that I'll buy the DVD or the Blu-ray and I'll convert it, because I don't want the kids touching the DVDs or the Blu-rays because the kids destroy them. You know, they're like, oh, look, it's a Frisbee or it's a coaster or it's a, you know, pretty and shiny. Insert the name of the way you want to damage the disc here, and they will find a way to make that happen for you. So you find yourself hiding hiding all the physical media from them. So for me, there was another benefit going digital, which was to save the carnage of those poor, defenseless discs. Anyhow, world's smallest violin, but never mind. Whereas the thing is with iTunes, though, is if you were to buy all the content exclusively through iTunes, you are locked in. But generally, that's not the way I've done it. And I'm leaning towards, you know, your idea regarding the physical media is still the better option, I think, really, when you consider it.
Yeah. So I'll just run through quickly how I buy my stuff. I buy Blu-ray. So then we've got the best possible quality copy of the movie, and I have a Blu-ray burner, so then I can rip that and encode it so that we can watch it on the Apple TV. And we recently bought a Blu-ray player so we can watch it immediately. The reason that I do this is so that then I'm not locking myself into that Apple platform, because I can buy the Blu-ray, I can strip it of all the DRM. That's a trivial process. And then I can do whatever I want with the resulting file. I can encode it into, you know, and it's a very, very high quality, like 1080p files that are encoded for the Apple TV. It's still really high quality. So I can do that, or I can encode all the way down to something that will play on my iPhone 4. So I I do it that way so that I still have that freedom, so that I still have the choice to be able to do what I want with my media. So that's something that has become important to me over the years, that I sort of realized that the more I buy from iTunes, the less I'm able to do with the things that I supposedly own. So I still buy physical because it is that it is, I think it's the best deal for consumers to buy physical, and then you can do what you will afterwards. You can even resell the discs after you've ripped it. You know, no one's going to stop you.
Yeah, and that's an interesting point about, you know, about the whole reselling thing and the concept of ownership and what do you own exactly. But rather than go down that rat hole, I just want to focus on something else just for a second. I mean, you and I are, in essence, special cases because we know how to do this stuff. The average person on the street probably doesn't. And even with an instruction manual, probably, you know, may well struggle with some of it, even though it's really not that hard. It does require some computer skills to do that. So the question is, for the average consumer, and there is such a thing, would they look at an Apple TV or a Chromecast or a Google TV or a Roku box or a Western Digital streaming box, any of those, and would they say, that is just much better than going to buy a Blu-ray? And I think generally the answer is no. But the more people get invested in things like iPads and iPhones, and they realize that they're these companion products, it's, you know, the halo effect is working. And the same is happening on the Android side, and people that have Xboxes as well and PlayStations, and they realize that you can actually do this. I think that transition is changing, and it is only a matter of time before the physical media, well, I think before the physical media eventually goes away, but it won't really fully go away until there's some kind of leveling of the playing field. Like the DRM, I think long term has to go in order for it to be truly democratized.
Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. And they really have to get rid of all this bloody encoder, different codecs. They need to just settle on one and run with it. And those two things are going to be what's going to keep physical media alive, because until they can sort that shit out, it's always going to be an uphill struggle in order to for customers to not feel like they're being locked in, because frankly, they are being locked in.
Yeah. So this is music has already gone through that transition of shedding DRM. And now the situation that we're getting is that there's a lot of different places where you can source your music from, and it's all going to be DRM free. And while they haven't stuck to the same codecs, it's a lot of devices can support a lot of the major codecs that are out there. So pretty much anything that you buy these days, everything you buy these days is going to be able to support MP3. And that's what most vendors use. And a lot of them support AAC, which is what Apple uses with iTunes. So there's no longer that platform lock-in. So you can buy something from iTunes and then play it on your Android phone or your Windows mobile phone. You can buy something from, if you're in America, Amazon and MP3 and then play it on your iPhone. And there are a heap of streaming services that are coming out now, and they make apps for every platform. So there's, I think we're seeing more of that. Media landscape for music is much better for consumers than TV shows and movie is currently.
Yeah, I'd say music is about 10 years ahead of where movies are. And I think that's a function of it's a function of two things. First of all, is that the movie and TV show industries they're clutching at their existing business models, like their lives depended on it. And probably, I don't know, to some extent, maybe some of them they do. But But the other reason is just a simple technological reason, and that is speed. It's easy to support all the different decoding codecs for audio because it requires significantly less CPU power. And whereas if you look at video, it especially 1080p, that requires quite a lot of grunt. And when you've got a device like the Apple TV is using hardware decoders, it's not decoding it through the CPU, it's going through optimized ASICs that are designed specifically to do H.264 and to offload that. And as has been the case on the iPhone and the iPod Touch from the very beginning, the Apple TV, the second generation Apple TV and Apple TV generation 3, they all use hardware decoding. And the problem with hardware decoding is that it's fast, it's energy efficient, but it's also restricted as in terms of flexibility. As time goes on, they will develop more and more ASICs that are able to handle a wider variety of codecs to the point at which a low-powered, generic device will be possible in the same way that music is essentially the same way. CPU power is almost getting there to the point at which, you know, you could make a relatively cheap device that could do all of your decoding in the CPU, but it's not quite low power or quite fast enough just yet, I think, for it, and perhaps the chipsets don't support enough the video formats. So I can see it coming, I can, but we're not quite there yet.
Yeah, something that is definitely going to take some time, but I don't think it's so much an issue of technology. It's the businesses and the executives that I think that's what's holding a lot of these things back, and the fact that all of these hardware makers that sort of latched onto the idea of, okay, well, if you buy things from us to use on our hardware and we can use that to lock you in, I think that's going to be hard for them to move away from. So I quite like the idea of movies and TV shows moving in the direction of music, because I think everything that we went through with music and how that changed over the last decade, that's been very beneficial to consumers. But I don't see that changing anytime soon, because of hardware and because of the business strategies that these companies are using.
I completely agree. When I say there's two aspects to it, the technological is clearly the easier one to deal with. It's the existing business models and the existing, because all the movie guys are looking at what happened to the music industry and they're saying, oh, this is not our savior. But the funny thing is they're trying to slow it down. They're trying to fight the tide, as it were. Inevitably, they're going to lose. The way it'll happen is it's already starting, is that it's being chipped away at a little piece at a time. And suddenly it'll be okay for Netflix to do whatever, and they'll be streaming a whole bunch of extra stuff, and then the next year it'll be a whole bunch of extra stuff again, and there'll be more in the back catalog, and Netflix will go global, and it just chips away at it a piece at a time until inevitably the movie studio guys will be looking around thinking, oh crap.
Yeah, I think there's a possibility, because you look at the Netflix is very popular where it's available.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of Australians that are prepared to go down the route of getting a VPN or a proxy set up so that they can stream things from Netflix, and leave Netflix changed their policy regarding credit cards some time ago, so that they don't necessarily care if you're using a credit card that's actually valid in the US, so you can use it from pretty well anywhere. They don't give a toss.
But then it's the monthly cost for Netflix plus the monthly cost of the VPN portal And the other problem that you've got with Netflix is also going through a VPN portal, especially going to Australia. You know, are you going to get sufficient bandwidth to have nice, smooth playback? And I know that certain people, I know that myself on ADSL 1, I think that I would struggle. And I think that unless you've got a really decent connection, like a ADSL 2 Plus connection where you're not greater than 5Ks from the exchange, you know, if you got decent bandwidth, you could do it. But it's going to cost more, to the point at which you've got to wonder if it's really worth it.
Hmm. Yeah. So once that you know, the availability thing isn't an issue anymore, I think it's really, you know, something that's really going to take off, and that will probably have the biggest effect on the movie industry in terms of, you know, what's available to us. Because that's going to, I can see that the Netflix model just steamrolling everything and just people switching to that model of, you know, you just stream it straight from Netflix. You don't have to worry about keeping the file or anything like that. And, you know, the only thing that's holding Netflix back, for people from using Netflix, is the infrastructure and how much that, you know, data caps and things like that. How much can they download in a month?
Yeah, and this is the whole problem with streaming services of any kind. It is, you're stuck in that dilemma, aren't you? You've got to have, not only have you got to have a reasonable amount of bandwidth, but you've got to have a decent download quota. And it's all well and good in, you know, in North America, you're hooked up with Fios. You can, yeah, in certain parts of the world where high-speed internet is ubiquitous, most people are not so ignorant to think that the whole world is like that, but there is an element of people out there that don't realize that that is simply not the norm. And you can't just assume that that is the case. And in many ways, I liken the fact that the iPhone would not have taken off the way it did were it not for the fact that 3G data was growing at the same time. And there was sort of a symbiotic growth after a certain point. But had 3G not been on the cusp of ubiquity, the iPhone would not have been in anywhere near as successful as it were. And the same is true with Netflix and their business model, because frankly, with the bandwidth that you need to have high bandwidth internet everywhere, and you need to have decent download quotas. Otherwise, again, people just won't use it.
So do you have anything else to say regarding music?
Yeah, I just wanted to quickly talk about the differences between buying and streaming. It's interesting because for me, streaming doesn't really do a hell of a lot for me, because I don't go to streaming and just say, oh, I like this, what else might I like to listen to, and then sit there and listen to different music for hours on end and then discover that this is really nice and I'll go buy that. And I've heard a lot of people say that that's the way that they use their RDO and their Spotify and their Pandora. It's about discovery of music. And that sort of replaces some of the functionality of the radio, of broadcast radio, is you can turn it on and they'll play the, you know, top 50, top 100, or depending on the station you're listening to, you might also get, you know, some old crap, but you never know. Point is that discovery service is now has a digital form in the form of streaming. And of course, I should neglected to mention iTunes Radio.
Well, it's not available over here yet, so.
Yeah, well, I know, but it will be, they're saying early next year, early 2014, they're saying it'll be coming here. But yeah, I know. But in any case, I think that that's great for those people that do that. For me, I don't really care, because I don't listen to the radio. And the thing is, I've got kids, I've got three at school now, and they all play all the latest songs or whatever from that. My wife also does like the radio, and so she'll play the radio in the car and I'll hear music that way. So I have no need for a discovery service, because honestly, I'm just not going to have the time to listen to it. And I discover my music through my kids and my wife, and that's enough for me. However, I can see the advantage of it. But something you were saying earlier was, although DRM is gone, streaming sort of is a little bit like DRM. Yeah, how about you talk about that for a second?
Yeah, we used to have DRM on the music, and that restricted where we could listen to it, what we could listen to it on, and what we could do with the files. You know, how many computers could we listen to the music on? Well, we're in a similar situation with music streaming now, because you have to listen to it from the service that it's coming from. You have to listen through their apps. You know, I don't think there's a third-party Spotify app that allows you to listen to their music through a third-party interface. You know, you have to use their web service, their apps on the iOS platform or the Android or wherever. So it is another form of DRM, because you're no longer in control of the music and what you can do with it. You're listening to this music at the behest of someone else. So I think it is DRM, but it's sort of that kind of innocuous DRM that people are okay with, that it's in some ways it's working to their benefit, that as long as they're happy using the service and listening through those apps, then it's fine. DRM is completely invisible to them, and it's not really restricting what they do, because they're happy working within those constraints that are placed there. So
yeah, I mean, people are happy to accept the fact that they're locked into listening to Spotify on Spotify using Spotify apps, on whatever devices Spotify is available on, which is not a huge amount, a number, but it's enough. But you're still locked into listening to it on that, as opposed to DRM-free music that you would download, at which point you can play it on whatever you like. So it's like you accept that restriction.
It's just accepted as, okay, well, that's
For the convenience.
That's part of the deal.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's a little bit more upfront than you know, the DRM that we saw on the iTunes store, because that's sort of, you didn't know about that until you really had the music, and perhaps you never read the support documentation, and one day you found out that, oh, I've authorized this iTunes account on too many computers, and you find out about the DRM after the fact. You know, it's possible to do that, but listening to music on Spotify or Pandora or, you know, whatever, that's part of the buy-in. That's, you're aware of that going into the deal, that, okay, to listen to the music that you're providing, I must use your service. So it's more acceptable for people to knowing that is the deal up front.
You know what would be really interesting is if all of the streaming services had a common format, and the library that you were able to listen to would be dependent upon your subscription. So you subscribe to Spotify and they might have some catalogs of an artist you really like, or you subscribe to Ardio because they've got a bunch of catalogs from different people. Yeah, that'd be really interesting, because then you could play that on anything. Like, it'd play through iTunes Radio or Spotify or Ardio or Pandora. It'd play through whatever app, whatever device, you know, it'd be all completely open.
Yeah, I think that would be a much better deal for consumers, and it would mean that Spotify doesn't have to cater for the tastes of everyone.
Exactly. And you could have smaller players that could pop up and be music boutique houses, if you like, for the alternative jazz scene from Slovenia or something. And you're like, oh man, I need some of that, you know, Slovenian jazz. I don't know. I just picked that because of Angers, but never mind that. It's a long story. No, it's not that long. But anyway, the point is, I think that all this acceleration of technology, it always precedes a standardization. So all of the technology that we've been seeing going on, it evolves so quickly, and all these different players pop up to try and service the needs or the wants of the general populace, and then comes a time of rationalization. So let's all agree on a Blu-ray standard, or let's all agree on the DVD standard, or let's all agree on an email standard or whatever, at which point then it becomes more competitive and more democratized and better for the consumer. In this sort of evolving stage that we're still in, it just isn't. You know, it's like we're on the path. You can see we're on the path, but we're just not there yet.
Yeah.
And we need the big players to democratize this and make it a common standard so that it can become fairer. And then, of course, it'll be something else. It'll be the next big thing of some kind, whatever that may be. Apps is a good example. I mean, games is a good example. I mean, think about a common gaming engine that's available across all the different platforms. And all you paid for was how good the games were. And the gaming platform was sort of collectively pushed together, pushed ahead as an industry-wide thing. You know what I mean? It's
yeah.
And then it would be more like Blu-ray and be more like DVDs. Of course, the counter argument to that is that the incentive to generate standards means that individual companies will not get the lock-in. So there's no interest. There's less interest from corporate world for standardization.
Yeah, while they're still getting, you know, presumably fat stacks of cash.
Yeah.
Coming in for locking in their customers.
Exactly.
There's zero motivation for moving to a standardized cross-platform alternative.
Yeah, and that's the ongoing, never-ending battle. Is we've got a new widget that does something fun, fantastic, that everyone wants. That's great. And we're going to do it in such a way that you're locked into our platform because we'll make more money that way. And it works for a while, and then other competitors come out and say, well, you know what? We're going to back this open standard. I mean, look at the way that web browsers like WebKit took on Internet Explorer and, well, put a massive dent in it. That's the sort of thing that needs to happen with digital movies and a little bit more with music online. It's gotten better, but it's still not quite there, you know?
Yeah.
Anyway, I can dream.
Mm. So let's have a quick look at the scene on books. So,
do you read a lot of ebooks?
No, I don't.
My wife does.
There's... You know, we can get things from the iBook store. We can get them from Amazon Kindle. Sony has the book reader. There's, I believe, the Kobo is available in Australia.
Yep.
So, you know, there's a number of different platforms that you can, number of different e-readers. But, of course, then we have the hardware platform lock-in thing again. So you can only really, you know, for the Sony books, you can only read them on the Sony. For the Kobo, you can only read them on the Kobo. Amazon is something different because you can buy their content on their Kindle and read it on the Kindle, but they also have the Kindle app. So you're still locked into the Amazon ecosystem, but because it's in an app, you can take that content no matter which device you're using. So you can be using an iPad or a Nexus 7 or a fucking whatever, and you can still read your Amazon book.
Yeah, it's supported devices that have their software that they've written on it.
Yeah. It's a bit more of an interesting... It's very weird, the book, you know, the e-book scene.
Yeah, that's very true. I think that Amazon are the odd man out insofar as they have gone to great lengths to ensure that you do have the ability, if you buy books within their ecosystem, to read them if you want on an iPad. Even though they don't make an iPad, they're in the business of selling you. They want you to come back and buy lots and lots of books from them. And whereas Apple, their attitude is more, hey, we've made this fantastic iPad. Isn't it beautiful? Oh, by the way, you can also read books on it. And years later, they eventually, with Mavericks, bring iBooks out for the Mac. So, like, as an afterthought, you know, oh, yeah, well, I guess we should probably put the ability to read books on the Mac as well, just in case you want to read them on your computer. Yeah. Amazon already there. I mean, Amazon, you've got, let's see, you've got the Kindles, like you said, the e-ink Kindles, you got the Kindle Fire, you've got the app for the iPad, the iPhone, and it's just, you know, it's far more flexible. But those are the two different models. For Apple, it's like a me too, whereas with Amazon, it's more their bread and butter. And my wife has a Kindle Paperwhite, and it's an absolutely beautiful e-reader. It really is lovely. And I've read a little bit on it, not nowhere near as much as she has, but I can see why people love their Kindles. I really can.
So what do you think about the, you know, the way that the books landscape is set up? Do you think that's a good thing for consumers? You know, is that a?
I think Amazon are a wolf in sheep's clothing. I think that they are actually quite a hostile company. Their business model long term, and I'm not a business analyst, but I mean, geez, look at it. Their business model is technically unsustainable. All it's going to take is a few years of bad results, and they're gone. They've got nothing left. They basically run it at practically no profit. They're breaking all the laws of business. But that's, and they do that because they don't charge enough profit on the stuff that they sell, and that includes their books. And some of the stuff that they do with their book pricing is crazy.
Oh yeah,
and it's funny that it'll be cheaper prices for a while. It's putting a lot of other people out of business, and including bricks and mortar stores. A lot of that blame has to rest with Amazon. But the truth is that yeah, it's not sustainable. And as for the technological side of things, DRM is everywhere. So you know, you can't read a Kindle book in an iBooks application. But the funny thing about that is that it's sort of different because, you know, you can't get an iTunes, it's not the best analogy, and it's not the best comparison, I'll admit, but assume that Apple wanted you to watch your content everywhere, then they would have an iTunes app on that was available for the Kindle Fire, let's say. But that's not what Apple's interested in. Apple's interested in locking you into their products, their hardware products, because that's where they make their money.
Hmm.
Whereas Amazon aren't interested in locking you into their products. They're only interested in their products are those that they sell, as opposed to, oh God, that sounds wrong, doesn't it? Because they sell the Kindles, but that's not what I mean. The products that they want to make their money on are the books, are the actual, the content you buy on there, whereas Apple's not so interested in making money on the content. It's just two different approaches to the same problem. Is it bad for consumers? I honestly do think that DRM on books should go, but the problem with books is because they're so small and they're so easy to upload and compress and upload, I should say. You can download 1,000 books in under a minute if you know where to look. And if there's no DRM, it'd just be rampant. No one would buy a book. At least with videos, it's a much bigger commitment, more bandwidth, and that'll be negated as time goes by and people get FiOS and so on. And that brings the whole piracy thing into play. I think the problem with books is that it's an old market. So you look at music, you look at movies and TV shows, really, in terms of personal distribution, hasn't really been a lot of it until the last 30, 40 years, whereas books have been around for hundreds of years. And having a library or even a bookshelf with books in it has been common in a lot of households for a long time. And breaking that paradigm and making it something better that is also consumer-friendly with a common platform is not something that's going to happen overnight. And Amazon's model works well for Amazon, but it doesn't help ebooks move forward as a concept, you know, like,
no,
yeah.
I don't think it does. And it's a bit of a hard one to work out, you know, what is the best model for digital books, you know?
Well, you need a common platform. I mean, they use what? Yeah. Mobi, I think it is, M-O-B-I. And
they use all sorts of crazy stuff.
Your EPUB, sorry. And there's a whole bunch of different formats, and even within those formats, there's different formats, and it's scary. And there's simply not enough standardization. So that's
something with it's having that diversity of formats and DRM structures and all this other shit that goes with it. It makes it very hard for publishers to get all of their content available on all the platforms.
Yeah, exactly,
you know,
right.
I don't know how easy or hard it is for the movie studios to pump out, you know, H.264s for the various suppliers that are out there, but you know, for digital books, all that I hear about it is that publishing a digital book is an absolute nightmare. So I don't think that that's doing anything to advance the platform at all.
Yeah, I totally agree. And as far as I'm aware, what you say is correct, is that it's very difficult to publish anything across platform. And some people will simply say, look, I was published on the Kindle, that's all I'm doing, because it was such a pain in the ass to do just that.
Where the money is.
Yeah. And other people said, well, you know what, I'm just going to develop for the iBook store. So I might use iTunes Author, and you know, because it's not bad software as software goes for developing books. But, you know, let's be honest, do I really then want to go and port that across to the Kindle? So, you know, if I was to write a book and self-publish, which, you know, the thought has crossed my mind, because I've written a bunch of short stories previously that did okay, but I want to do a novel, but I just don't have the time to do it. If I were to do it, though, I would put it on the Amazon store. I'd sell it for Kindles and Kindle apps, because the market is that much larger. Despite the fact that I know
there's more opportunity there for you to make sales.
Yes, but despite the fact that I do know that Amazon will cut the legs out from under me anytime they feel like it. So they'll do the whole, you know, oh, that's on special. You sell 10,000 copies and, oh, well, by the way, because it was on special, you didn't make as much. Yeah, that's the risk you take with Amazon. And I find that, you know, that's reprehensible, but never mind that. Anyway, I think the bottom line is that books and ebooks need to have some kind of common agreement as to what format they're in. There needs to be an industry standard set of tools that are cross-platform that authors can use to publish to any platform. And it's still the Wild West out there. One of the things that motivated Apple to do iTunes Author, I read, was that the standard EPUB format simply didn't have all the interactive capability that they wanted to provide, which, yeah, I understand that. And Apple are perfectly willing to pour the time and money into extending a file format such that they can add more functionality and more usability. Now, I'm all for that, but at the same time, it illustrates the problem, is that ebook tools were originally designed for static text and images, even the early ones, you know, very basic. And things have evolved, things are moving forward, but there doesn't seem to be enough standardization happening at the same time. So again, I honestly don't think that it is all that great for the consumer, because it comes back to the same thing with the DVDs and Blu-ray discs, is I buy a book. Anyone can pick up, like a physical book, anyone can pick it up and read it. Presumably they know how to read. And I guess, well, obviously it's a level argument, since if you can read a Kindle, you can read a book. The point is that, getting sidetracked, is that the book itself can be handed to anybody you like and they can read it. It's not locked into any platform at all. It's just whoever holds it in their hand. The downside of the digital method is that it introduces that other variable. You can no longer just say, here, have a copy of this book, I'm finished reading it. And if your device dies or Amazon goes under, you've lost everything. You've got nothing to show for it. So, I don't know. Whereas if it was available on other platforms, you could move it across, keep a copy of it, load it up onto another platform, and away you go. And you wouldn't be dependent upon anything to do with Amazon. And that's the ideal place where it should end. But I think it's because of its momentum, because of the long-standing nature of the publishing industry that predates music and predates movies, I think that it's going to be a more difficult one to turn around.
Yeah, so something you just said then about, you know, if Amazon goes under, well, there's your books gone. Reminded me of something that I come up with when I was researching all this, is that Adobe had various DRM schemes for encoding PDFs, and they, at some point in the last 5 years, they've decided, well, we're not going to support that those DRM systems anymore. We're not going to keep the servers active anymore. So if you had PDFs that use those DRM schemes, well, that's it. Can't read them anymore because Adobe isn't going to verify that you got them, you know, got them legally.
Now, that's a bit annoying, isn't it? It comes back to the concept of what do you own in the digital world. I mean, I know people snicker and laugh at me when I sort of say, oh, yeah, I've got Blu-ray backups of all this stuff. And it's like, why don't you just download whatever? And apart from the fact that I've got an ADSL 1 connection, if I just downloaded everything every time I did a reinstall, and I know I'm talking about software, but the same principle applies to books. And I do have a bunch of ebooks, and they are backed up on a Blu-ray disc because, well, what if the server is gone tomorrow? So, but then I think like that. I'm a geek, and you know, I'll burn a Blu-ray disc and store it in a Blu-ray DVD CD wallet, whatever you want to call it. And I'll do that, but majority of people don't do that, and that's the hidden piece that most people don't think about. They think it's always going to be there. The reality is, if history teaches it anything, it teaches us anything, is that it's not going to be there. So. I don't know. It's interesting how many times you can end up paying for the same damn thing in the virtual world as opposed to the physical world, if you know what I mean.
Hmm. Yeah, well, I've had you know, apps that I've bought. They're not available on the iTunes store anymore, so that's why I still download apps in iTunes just so that I always have them. And if one day I find that they're not available, as you know, I found with the case of one particular app that, you know, we don't use it all the time, but you know, when we want to use it, we want to use it. I go, oh, it's not on this device. I'll just download it again. Nope, gone. I go, what do you mean it's gone?
Yeah, and the other
says, not sorry, guy, I can't help you.
The other thing that's interesting as well is that with computers, it's been a stable interface for a long time. And when I say that, I mean you've got keyboard, mouse, monitor, push the mouse around, cursor moves around, clickety-doo-dah, away you go. Now, that's all well and good if you got emulators, because you can develop an emulator to emulate an old, you know, 68,000 Motorola chip, and you can run your old, like, Basilisk and Sheep Shaver and all those ones, right? You can emulate that. You can even emulate... you can run, if you've got VMware Fusion, you can go, or Parallels. You can run Windows on your machine, Windows 95, 3.11, yeah, whatever you like, and play your old games, DOS Windows, with things like DOSBox. You can do all that. But with the iPad, with specialized hardware like that, I do wonder, will there be a generic tablet device in the future that can emulate older iPads with older games? Or are we going to reach a point where everything's just gone? Because the latest version of the operating system, the app needed to be updated. If the operating system and the app is now, you know, no longer updated by the developer, does that mean that all that, those games and that history is gone because you no longer have a platform for it to run on? And that's another issue. I realize that's talking about apps, but yeah, it's something else that
I think is a real possibility. You know, and really, it could happen with any of these things.
Yeah, exactly right. So. It's difficult. The digital, the whole advancement of technology just happens so fast compared to the standards, and the standards simply cannot keep up because you need consensus, and for that you need to have several players that have gone out and tested the waters and done their own thing, and then you've got to bring them back to the table and get them to agree on a standard. And that's hard, and it takes time. All the while, yeah. Any content created is... locked in one form or another. And that lock-in, and I think lock-in generally, you can make a generic statement, lock-in is bad for consumers. I think that's the bottom line. Choice is always better. And honestly, I think looking at the way music has gone, just to try and sort of bring this back to where we started, is that with DRM going away, and common support for all the different encoding formats, that's where all the rest of this has to go. Otherwise, you know, the best options will still be physical media or physical books.
Yeah, I tend to agree with that. This has been Anodized. Don't forget to check out anodizedpodcast.com for show notes or more information on the show. You can also follow Anodized on Twitter and app.net at Anodized Podcast. You can also follow both myself and John, me at Clinton1550 and John at John Chichi, respectively. So before we go, please give us a rating on iTunes, give us a review. It's the best thing that you can do to help us out. And if you have any feedback, we'd absolutely love to hear it. Mention the Twitter account. If you go to our website, you can find a little contact link on the top right corner. Send us an email. So if you have any suggestions, any feedback, we'd absolutely love to hear it.
Can I just make an addendum to that?
Yeah.
My addendum goes like this. We really would love any feedback. If you agree vehemently or not, or disagree with us vehemently or not, really would love to start any conversations regarding what we've talked about during this episode and during any of our episodes at any time. So please get in touch. Let us know what you think. We'd love to talk more about it to anyone who wants to. So please go ahead and do that.
So thank you very much for listening, and we'll hope that you'll join us again next time.